dust is on the ground. That's when wacky pumpkins can be found. Start your search. Look around. They're small, they're orange, and almost round. It's Halloween time, and again this year, Wacky the All-American has hidden baby wacky pumpkins throughout Kentuckiana. Each pumpkin contains a valuable certificate. So play it cool, ghoul, and start searching.
Just a reminder that the Great Pumpkin will be here in 15 minutes with ghost stories. I'm delighted to know that you believe in ghosts. After all, they believe in you. The best way to listen to ghost stories, of course, is with the lights out. There's nothing like a dark room to attract ghosts. Then close the door and draw the blinds. Just keep telling yourself that you aren't frightened and nothing can scare you. How do you prove? It's officially Halloween, October 31st. Welcome to annual wacky spooktacular.
Good evening, children. This is the Great Pumpkin, inviting you to join me for the rest of the evening, and perhaps part of the morning. My tales of terror are guaranteed to make you wake up screaming. If you can go to sleep, join us now as we take a giant step into the blackness of the supernatural. Judge Birmute, who was giving his opinion of the mysterious affair that had happened at St. Cloud. For a month, Paris had doted on this inexplicable crime. No one could understand it at all. M. Birmute, standing with his back to the chimney, talked about it, discussed the diver's opinion, but came to no conclusion. Many women had risen and come nearer, remaining standing with eyes fixed upon the shaven mouth of the magistrate, which issued these grave words. They shivered and vibrated, crisp through their curious fear, through that eager, insatiable need of terror which haunts their soul, tormenting them and torturing them like a hunger. One of them, paler than the others, after a silence, said, "It is frightful. It touches the supernatural. We shall never know anything about it." The magistrate turned toward her, saying, "Yes, madame, it is probably that we never shall know anything about it. As for the word supernatural, when you come to use that, it has no place here. We are in the presence of a crime skillfully conceived, very skillfully executed, and so well enveloped in mystery that we cannot separate the impenetrable circumstances which surround it. But once in my life, I had to follow an affair which seemed truly to be mixed up with something very unusual. However, it was necessary to give it up, as there was no means of explaining it. Many of the ladies called out at the same time so quickly that their voices sounded as one. Oh, tell us about it. M. Demute smiled gravely, as judges should, and replied, "You must not suppose for an instant that I, at least, believed there was anything superhuman in the adventure. I believe only in normal causes. And if in place of using the word supernatural to express what we cannot comprehend, we should simply use the word inexplicable. It would be much better. In any case, the surrounding circumstances in the affair I am going to relate to you, as well as the preparatory circumstances, have affected me much. Here are the facts. I was then judge of instruction at Ajaccio, a little white town lying on the border of an admirable gulf that was surrounded on all sides by high mountains. When I particularly had to look after, there were the affairs of vendetta. Some of them were superb, as dramatic as possible, ferocious and heroic. We find there the most beautiful subjects of vengeance that one could dream of. Hatred a century old, appeased for a moment, but never extinguished. Abominable plots, assassinations becoming massacres, and almost glorious battles. For 2 years, I heard of nothing but the price of blood of the terribly prejudiced Corsican, who is bound to avenge all injury upon the person of him who is the cause of it, or upon his nearest descendants. I saw old men and infants, cousins with their throats cut, and my head was full of these stories. One day, we learned that an Englishman had rented for some years a little villa at the end of the gulf. He had brought with him a French domestic pig, the Marseille duck. Soon everybody was occupied with this singular person who lived alone in his house, only going out to hunt and fish. He spoke to no one, never came to the town, and every morning practiced shooting with a pistol and a rifle for an hour or two. Some legends about him were abroad. They pretended that he was a high personage, fled from his own country or political reasons. Then they affirmed that he was concealing himself after having committed a frightful crime. They even cited some of the particularly horrible details. In my capacity of judge, I wished to get some information about this man, but it was impossible to learn anything. He called himself Sir John Rowell. I contented myself with watching him closely, although in reality there seemed nothing to suspect regarding him. Nevertheless, as rumors on his account continued, grew, and became general, I resolved to try and see this stranger myself, and for this purpose began to hunt regularly in the neighborhood of his property. I waited long for an occasion. It finally came in the form of a partridge, which I shot and killed before the very nose of the Englishman. My dog brought it to me, but immediately taking it, I went and begged Sir John Rowell to accept the dead bird, excusing myself for intrusion. He was a tall man with red hair and red beard, very large, a sort of placid, polite Hercules. He had none of the so-called British haughtiness, and heartily thanked me for the delicacy in French with a beyond-the-channel accent. At the end of a month, we had chatted together 5 or 6 times. Finally, one evening, as I was passing by his door, I perceived him astride a chair in the garden smoking his pipe. I saluted him, and he asked me in to have a glass of beer. It was not necessary for him to repeat before I accepted. He received me with the fastidious courtesy of the English, spoke in praise of France and of Corsica, and declared that he loved that country and that shore. Then, with great precaution, in the form of a lively interest, I put some questions to him about his life and his projects. He responded without embarrassment, told me that he had traveled much in Africa, in the Indies, and in the Americas. He added, laughing, "I have had many adventures." "Oh, yes." I began to talk about hunting, and he gave me many curious details of hunting, the hippopotamus, the tiger, the elephant, and even the hunting of the gorilla. I said, "All these animals are very formidable." He laughed, "Oh no, the worst animal is man." then he began to laugh with the hearty laugh of a big, contented Englishman. He continued, I have often hunted man also. He spoke of weapons and asked me to go into his house to see his guns of various makes and kinds. His drawing room was huge and hung in black silk embroidered with gold. There were great yellow flowers running around. Is it Japanese cloth, he said? I said, I would imagine it is. Yes, he said. But in the middle of a large panel, a strange thing attracted my eye. Upon a square of red velvet, a black object was attached. I approached and found it was a hand. The hand of a man. Not a skeleton hand, white and characteristic, but a black, desiccated hand with yellow joints with the muscles bare and on them traces of old blood, a blood that seemed like a scale over the bone, sharply cut off at about the middle of the forearm, as with the blow of a hatchet. About the wrist was an enormous iron chain, riveted, soldered to this unclean member, attaching it to the wall by a ring sufficiently strong to hold an elephant. I said, what is it? The Englishman responded tranquilly. It belonged to my worst enemy. It came from America. It was broken with a saber, cut off with a sharp stone, and dried in the sun for 8 days. Oh, very good for me, that was. I touched the human relic, which must have belonged to a colossus. The fingers were immoderately long and attached by enormous tendons that held the straps of skin in place. This dried hand was frightful to see, making one think naturally of the vengeance of a savage. I said, this man must have been very strong, with gentlemen and gentleness, the Englishman answered. Oh, yes, but I was stronger than he. I put this chain on him to hold him. I thought he spoke in jest and replied, the chain is useless now, but the hand cannot escape. Sir John Rowell replied gravely, it always wishes to escape. The chain is necessary. With a rapid, questioning glance, I asked myself, is he mad? Or is this an unpleasant joke? But the face remained impenetrable, tranquil and friendly. I spoke of other things and admired the guns. Nevertheless, I noticed 3 loaded revolvers on the pieces of furniture, as if this man lived in constant fear of attack. I went there many times after that. Then for some time I did not go. We had become accustomed to his presence. He had become indifferent to us. A whole year slipped away. Then one morning, toward the end of November, my domestic awoke me with an announcement that Sir John Rowell had been assassinated in the night. A half hour later, I entered the Englishman's house with the central commissary and the captain of police. The servant, lost in despair, was sweeping at the door. I suspected him at first, but afterward found that he was innocent. The guilty one could never be found. Upon entering Sir John's drawing room, I perceived his dead body stretched out upon its back in the middle of the room. His waistcoat was worn. A sleeve was hanging, and it was evident that a terrible struggle had taken place. The Englishman had been strangled. His frightfully black and swollen face seemed to express an abominable fear. He held something between his set teeth and his neck, pierced with 5 holes, apparently done with a pointed iron, was covered with blood. A doctor joined us. He examined closely the prints of fingers in the flesh and pronounced these strange words. One would think that he had been strangled by a skeleton. A shiver ran down my neck, and I cast my eyes to the place on the wall where I had seen the horrible, torn-off hand. It was no longer there. The chain was broken and hanging. Then I bent over the dead man and found in his mouth a piece of one of the fingers of the missing hand, cut off, or rather sawed off, by the teeth, exactly at the second joint. Then they tried to collect evidence. They could find nothing. No door had been forced, no window opened, or piece of furniture moved. The two watchdogs on the premises had been aroused. Here, in a few words, is the disposition of the servant. For a month, his master had seemed agitated. He had received many letters which had been burned immediately. Upon taking a whip in anger, which seemed like dementia, he had struck in fury this tried hand fastened to the wall and taken, one knew not how, at the moment of a crime. He had retired late and shut himself in with care. He always carried arms. Often in the night, he talked out loud, as if he were quarreling with someone. On that night, however, there had been no noise. And it was only on coming to open the windows that the servant had found Sir John assassinated. He suspected no one. I communicated what I knew of the death to the magistrates and public officers, and they made minute inquiries upon the whole island. They discovered nothing. One night, 3 months after the crime, I had a frightful nightmare. It seemed to me that I saw the hand, that horrible hand, running like a scorpion or a spider along my curtains and my walls. 3 times I awoke. 3 times I fell asleep and again saw that hideous relic galloping about my room, moving his fingers like paws. The next day, they brought it to me, found in the cemetery upon the tomb where Sir John Rowell was interred. For they had not been able to find his family. The index finger was missing. This, ladies, is my story. I know no more about it. The ladies were terrified, pale and shivering. One of them cried, "But that is not the end, for there was no explanation. We cannot sleep if you do not tell us. What was your idea of the reason of it all?" The magistrate smiled with severity and answered, "Oh, certainly, ladies. But it will spoil all your terrible dreams. I simply think that the legitimate proprietor of the hand was not dead, and that he came for it with the one that remained to him. But I was never able to find out how he did it. It was one kind of revenge." One of the women murmured, "No, it could not be thus." And the judge of information, smiling still, concluded, "I told you in the beginning that my explanation would not satisfy you." My windshield wipers cut eye-shaped arcs through the water sheets that drenched the glass, like rubber fingers wiping tears from a corpse eye. Twin cones of headlight yellow pushed feebly out of the night's blackness and the pouring rain. From the road, I could see the lights of the vacationers' cabins, spots of luminosity dimmed by the mist that rose from the lake. Then the pinpoint lights were gone, and only wet blackness surrounded me, closing in. The moving light from my headlamps, the only evidence of life in a night world of fog and water. The road began to pitch upward, climbing, and I peered ahead and presently saw a dripping sign at the side of the road that read, "Weirvale, 1 mile. I grinned at the name. They were going all out in the town to catch their share of summer resort trade from the lake. Weird reports had trickled out from the isolated little hamlet indicating that werewolves prowled the countryside, undoubtedly a publicity trick to trap the interest of the morbidly curious. No one believed the rumors, of course, with the possible exception of those few who believed in the supernatural and horrendous. And though I'd griped about it, my editor had sent me up here to get a tongue-in-cheek angle story for possible publication in the paper's Sunday supplement. Had the weather been good, I'd have considered a break to get away from the hot asphalt blanket of the city. But in the rain and fog, driving along an unknown country road at night wasn't exactly my idea of a vacation. Suddenly, the rain stopped, as though a faucet handle had been turned off by some giant hand hidden in the sky. I braked sharply, feeling the tires skid in mud as a house loomed through the mist at the side of the road. This was the beginning of the village. I turned the wheel and bumped up a driveway toward the house. The weak amber light from inside limed two stolid figures sitting in rockers on the porch. With the reins in, the original feeling of wry humor with which I had approached this assignment returned. Why not get some fun out of it? In fact, why not do a completely humorous article on the werewolves of Weirvale? I thought. And in this vein, I approached the old couple on the porch. They didn't change the rhythm of their rocking, and their faces remained stolid, expressionless masks, as I smilingly introduced myself and told them of my mission. Where had the werewolves been seen? Who had seen them? I queried for a long, silent moment. Neither spoke, and for one fleeting second, I had the eerie thought that they were lifeless creatures of the fog. Then the man answered, "Ain't werewolves." "That's the truth," the woman nodded. "Lies they be," the old man quavered. A swirl of fog shifted between us, and their figures wavered and were momentarily blotted out. I peered through the mist and chuckled. "Then there's no truth to the stories that have come in from this town." The shroud-like vapor parted, and the old man shook his head. "No truth. Lies ain't werewolves." The woman leaned forward slightly, her lipless mouth forming quick spitting words. "Ain't werewolves at all. It's vampires." "That's the truth. Vampires." Her mate nodded vehemently. For a moment, I was wordless. Then the humor of the situation struck me, and I laughed outright. Of course, the old couple were playing part of the game, too. They wanted to reap some of the gain from the horrible hoax. Still laughing, I thanked them, got back into my car, and drove into the heart of the small village. I pulled up in front of the general store, the only building that exhibited any signs of life. Inside, a small, cadaverous man listened to my inquiry about lodging in the town. There was no hotel, he informed me. But there was an old couple who owned a farm up the road who occasionally took in boarders. Further inquiry elicited the fact that the couple he referred to were the old man and woman I had spoken to just a few minutes previously. I asked him if I could leave my car under an overhang attached to the store, and receiving an affirmative, I left, drove the car under the overhang, and began walking the short distance to the farmhouse. A hail from behind turned me as the storekeeper glided by. The man's eyes shifted back and forth and came to rest in the general direction of my face. He leaned forward and whispered, "I shouldn't have told you about them taking in lodgers. Don't go. Listen, I have a bunk behind the store. You can use that. They aren't safe." "What do you mean they aren't safe?" He stared at me and his mouth clamped shut. For a moment we stood still, the fog shifting around our feet. Then I began to grin. It was all part of the same game, the same deception. I turned and continued toward the farmhouse. A hand grabbed my arm, swung me around. The storekeeper's face was close to mine. His breath was foul, and I turned my head to avoid it. "They're werewolves. That's what I mean," he hissed. "Do you understand? They're werewolves." This time I didn't laugh, even though it was still amateurishly funny. I was becoming a little fed up with the whole routine. I pushed his hand away and continued on a bit faster. Foul weather, a bunch of country fools fumbling, pulling a fast one to prey on the thrill seeker and the morbid minded to make a quick buck. It wasn't turning out to be the ball I had thought it would be. I'd wrapped it up in the morning and, whoops, hands grabbed my coat from behind again. Insistent now, pulling at me. "Come back with me. You can't go there. They're werewolves." Exasperated, I said tightly, "Let's go," and swung my arm backward viciously to break his clawing hold. He reeled, his feet unsure in the mud, and suddenly he fell, his head hitting a rock with a dull thud. He didn't move. I leaned over him and saw that he was unconscious. Suddenly, I felt ashamed of what I'd done. The old man might be badly hurt. I picked him up in my arms, surprised at his thin lightness, and carried him toward the farmhouse. It was the old man who opened the door for me, the woman standing behind him, staring. I lowered the storekeeper into a musty, lumpy couch. His eyelids fluttered, and he began to move as I turned to the old farmer couple to explain, but they paid no heed, their eyes focused on the mound on the couch. The woman leaned forward and screamed, "Vampire! Filthy, blood-sucking, bad vampire!"
Spitting, they began to creep toward the storekeeper. It all seemed so real that for a second I felt the hair on the back of my neck began to rise. Then anger pushed at me. Anger at this farce and the fact that their silly acting had even gotten to me. I grabbed the old man's arm. Look, I've had just about enough of this crazy business. Let's drop it right now, huh? I turned to the storekeeper, who stood now in front of the couch. I opened my mouth to say more, but the words never came. Icy hands seemed to move over my flesh, and my mind reeled in shuddering rebellion, for the man was changing before my eyes into a fetid fiend, a bat-like thing, a vampire. The old couple leaped upon the creature as it scuttled toward the door. Like some fantastic alien ballet, they struggled soundlessly for a moment, then the devilish thing was smashed to the floor, and silently, grimly, the old couple killed it, driving a stake of wood from the fireplace into its heart as it writhed on the threadbare, blood-spattered rug. Shaken, my mind in a staccato daze, I stood there frozen as the old couple came toward me, murmuring soothing words, telling me it was all right now, the vampire's dead. Gently, they took me by the arms and led me to an inner door. The woman whispering, "You must rest now. You've been through a lot. You must rest." The old man opened the door. A flight of rickety steps led down the cobwebbed black maw of a moldy cellar. I turned my head to stammer a protest, but the words froze on my tongue. The old couple were changing. Coarse hair sprouting from their skin pores, their eyes turning yellow, gleaming hungrily between almond lids. Sharp fangs dripped bubbling froth like brew from a witch's cauldron, and a fetid, bestial odor clogged my nostrils. With the pungency of decay, I tried to struggle, but their paws tightened like steel bands into my flesh. They pushed, and I fell, hurtling down the broken stairs into blackness. The door slammed shut. I was alone in the awful dark. Whimpering, insane sounds in my mind. A gibbering chaos. I heard a scream. Keening through the black, a high sound flying on wings of torment and insane incoherency. A weird whistle to the hounds of death. And then I knew. The scream was mine. The last poignant cry of a human creature before the mind snapped. Before it became a crawling, mindless thing. Stirring in the hideous nightmare world of insanity. The scream rose higher, higher, blending with the cosmos, becoming nothing, becoming all.